So the question you're asking is, I think, why were rates held low?
And right. And if you're sympathetic to those arguments and to the
conundrum. Let me say there's monetary policy is a very difficult job. And so second guessing, looking at it after the fact, is particularly precarious, and you should be very guarded about it. I've asked lots of people about this, including people there, and there's different answers. You get also, can now read the transcripts of a lot of this period. You got different answers. One, as you mentioned, the concerns about deflation. That makes sense because you had had a conference in Woodstock in 1999, which talked about what the Fed should do if deflation seems to be a risk, and that was to hold rates low for a while and bring them up slowly. So that's what happened. So there's sort of research there. Alan Meltzer's history of the Fed, he mentions that Greenspan talked about the deflation risks. Ben Bernanke was on the board, clearly talked about deflation risks in Japan. And so people had seen Japan and were concerned about that sort of a downward spiral. So I think that was a factor. Now a lot of people don't focus on that so much. For example, 9/11 had occurred in 2001. And so you had you also had the dot-com bubble before that, so there's still this little concern about raising rates. However, this is going into 2004 we're talking about, so that's 3 years later. So I think that's still stretching it a little bit to explain some of this. I think as I hear the various people making comments about why it happened, by the way, there are some officials at the Fed who do think rates were too low. They've been outspoken, so it's not the current and the former chairman. The former chairman doesn't say they were low. They were too low. He just says it wouldn't make much difference. So, and the current one argues they weren't too low. So, I would say that, and others you can ask a whole lot of people, some who were on the board, or some who still are, who argue rates were too low. By the way, you also, it's an interesting thing. I don't know to what extent you examining in interviews with other countries, but this idea of rates being too low is a common view outside the United States. So, for example, Europeans always think that they so often think that's really what happened, and they also talk about how those low rates probably caused the European Central Bank to have rates that were too low. And I write about that in my book, actually. But there's definitely that sense that they couldn't have rates too much higher because concerns about the euro appreciating, et cetera. So there's that connection. And I think if you do talk to, I don't know how many, sometimes you can't really, people can't talk about all these things being in their current jobs. But I think there's a general feeling outside the United States that this was a problem. And there's sort of, perhaps because you want to be more critical or not as from outside, but there's no question about that. So, but I think the bottom line of all this, in terms of the why, thinking about it, is that the perfect is the enemy of the good problem. The Federal Reserve had done really terrific work and teams keeping the economy stable for a couple of decades, a great moderation period. And I think there's a tendency, can we do even better? We can do better than that. And to do better than that, you want to, think about risk management. Maybe we'll deviate a little bit from what has worked. We'll keep the rate extra low. We'll start talking about doing these new things. And so being more discretionary. And I think that's how the bottom line here, I think. Obviously, people trying to do the right thing. And in this case, they tried, and ultimately, I think, it did more harm than good.
It's interesting to hear. I don't know if we can actually interview the head of the European Central Bank. on these issues, and they've clearly the interconnections in the world are a fascinating part of this crisis. Both, you know, German banks buying our assets, Germans investing in Spain, and driving a large part of that real estate bubble.
Absolutely. I mean, and you have, like, within the ECB, you know, some people would just offhand say, "Well, how can this interest rate deviation explain anything when you had housing boom in Spain and Ireland and Greece, and you had modest in Germany and Austria?" But the truth is, if you look at the deviations from the interest, the European Central Bank's interest rate, they correlate very well with that explanation. So, if they could have had their overall European interest rate just 1.5-2 percentage points higher, then you would have had closer to the right policy for Spain, Greece, and Ireland, and I don't think it would have been harmful for, on the other side of the curve, the Germans and the Austrians and the other people in the middle. So I think it does help explain what happened in Europe. This theory explains. Actually, this is the chart here.
You have one chart of this, I know, and I forget, the Doko et al. Paper has a different...
Well, my chart comes from the OECD, so you should definitely please look at all the work here. Yeah, this is what I mean. Mm-hmm. I did remember the countries properly. So if you could have had the rate somewhat higher, you could have, I think, avoided some of this and wouldn't have had too much harm here. Right, because they have the same rate, is the thing. Right? It's the same rate. So the deviations from their local...
leading to the conditions. The 2010 discussions now, especially with the troubles in Greece and Spain about European integration really is the great thing it was promised to be.
Yeah. Well, it would work better if they had a higher rate.
I think they actually have learned from this, and they're now much more reluctant to. In fact, the idea of this European Central Bank being influenced by the interest rate of the Fed, I've raised that as a problem for several years, and now I'd say the reaction is we're not doing that. You know, we'll say we're not following the Fed. So, for whatever. I'm going to bring my computer up because there's lots of references here if you want to ask me. So, in particular, this the OECD I refer to there, but there's been more work over there on this issue. And so the Fed paper, is that the Doko?
The Doko et al. We've read, and some of the others, but if you want to send us any of the other ones you've referenced, you can either in real time or even after this interview, if you want to send us the references, we will make sure to read them and to send them.
Oh, okay, good. I will do that.
To bring this work to the Commission.
Good. I'll do that.
The Commission's attention.
Okay. Keep going.
Switching gears a little bit, another chapter of this book, another issue that you focus on that I think was key throughout the crisis was this question about whether the breakdown in the interbank markets were issues of liquidity or credit. I think clearly, and there's subtler versions, I think, of the credit question. So I'd like to just explore that a little bit. If you've updated your views, or if you still feel fundamentally from either from this evidence or from newer evidence that what was fundamentally at work was counterparty risk.
Oh yeah,
rather than liquidity.
Now we know for sure it was counterparty risk. I don't think there's any question about that, given what has happened. I mean, given what happened later when we saw these problems on the bank's balance sheets. I think at the time in August of 2007, I remember talking a lot to people. It was over in Europe, and how could Deutsche Bank be worried about lending to Citi? You would say, how could? And now, I mean, obviously they should be worried. So at the time, there was a debate whether it was the counterparty risk or liquidity. And the terms liquidity is always hard to define, but counterparty risk isn't. And I think it was an important point to try to get a handle on that. And I started working on it very early because I just have a lot of interest in this, in the funds market, I have had for many years. And I'd never seen anything like this before. So to me, as a researcher, you just want to get your hands around it. So I started studying earlier, and most of the work was with John Williams at the San Francisco Fed. He was actually taking some time off at Stanford for part of this period, and we thought of different ways to get a handle on this. We weren't thinking about the term auction facility originally. It was really just trying to understand what was causing this. And so we thought of different ways to do it. We had talked to Daryl Duffy a lot, who's a colleague of mine in the business school, and thought about this sort of other measures of risk, and looked at CDS originally and the spread between secured and unsecured lending, repo LIBOR spreads. And when we put those into account, we could explain a lot of the jump. And so we thought that was evidence for counterparty risk early on, and still do. I think now it's just it's got to be conventional wisdom. What else could, you know, we now know what happened. But at the time, in the fall of 2007, I think up until maybe Bear Stearns, and certainly through the panic, not everybody agreed with that. In fact, I would say the reaction of my work with Williams was quite negative from the Fed, from the rest of the Fed, because John isn't the Fed. There was other papers written. New York, Dallas did some papers. They did events, sort of a announcement effect studies of the TAF. Actually, I probably just got a little bit ahead of myself. We also then, since then, the term auction facility was introduced. We could then say, well, did that have an effect? And I think we were thinking there, well, this is a measure of liquidity. This is, now we have another variable, which is this extra provision of liquidity. And we found that didn't really affect things very much. And that was received quite negatively. And of course, when originally the spread came down a bit, the LIBOR OI spread came down a little bit, but then went up again and ultimately was not affected. So I think that this was an opportunity to do a lot of work, and it was mainly just a reaction to these people saying it wasn't working, and I think that was unfortunate.
So there's still a view out there, though, that in general, if you look at the amount of subprime paper, or the amount of, you know, would eventually be, you know, the most toxic, of course, for the CDOs, which had concentrated a lot of the credit risk into even the AAA tranches of the CDOs because of the high correlation of the underlyings. But that's still, you know, losses taken throughout the crisis across a large number of banks greatly exceed, on some extent, you know, that value. This is the arguments he's made. So the effect, which you know, one view of this, I think, is, and I'd like to get your opinion of this, you know, what initially may have been liquidity concerns or just, you know, great uncertainty about where the opacity, about where the assets lay, how mm-hmm. severe they were, you know, had risk actually been spread throughout the economy or not. Mm-hmm. Once you start getting a liquidity crisis, it becomes one and the same of a solvency crisis. If I'm going to pull my money and my funding back from you, you're going to have to sell assets, even good assets. In which case, then it's counterparty risk, and they're more intertwined than we would like.
Absolutely.
To think.
And in some sense, the if you could think about where they really get intertwined is if a bank is becoming concerned about its own balance sheet, then it's going to be reluctant to lend, and so it will look like liquidity when it's effectively kind of counterparty risk on the bank's own balance sheet. And also, by the way, during this period, we spent a lot of time talking to traders. And I, because of my earlier work on the funds market, I knew quite a bit, still around in New York, and went and visited them. I guess it was I can't remember exact dates, but November or December 2007. And their reaction was liquidity. They said, we're not getting enough. They would say, we don't have enough balance sheet. It's the term that you don't have a balance sheet to invest. And so that's what they would say. Not everyone, but and so if you just talk to people directly, they were not focused on the counterparty risk. Now those are the people in the banks, and they, of course, the traders might not have any idea. After I just mentioned hundreds of regulators didn't have any idea, so they might not have known. Or the other possibility here is that the amount of balance sheet they're getting is determined by their bosses to some extent, right? And so the bosses might realize there's these risks, and therefore being more circumspect about providing the funds. So it still could be risk, but the guys we're talking to don't perceive it that way. So you got to be really careful here in terms of talking to people in the markets. Got to talk to people in the markets. It's essential, but you also have to look at the data.
So this is a distinction that says, I won't lend to you. So one part of the counterparty, or one part of the sort of credit risk story is, I won't lend to you because I'm not worried. I'm worried about your solvency. Mm-hmm. Right, and you think that was clearly part of the story.
Yes.
The second variant you've just described is, I won't lend to you because I don't. I'm not exactly sure of my own balance sheet.
Yes. It's very related. That's also, I would say, that's, you could think of that as liquidity, and some people do, but I think that's still based on the fundamental. There is the risk of the assets. Yeah. But then eventually, of course, you have this liquidity, which we did have a liquidity crisis in the panic. There's no question about that. But people are unable to sell their collateral. You know, it's the thing that now many people have talked about. Giannakopoulos, in particular, has written, I think, quite effectively about that. Gary Gordon as well.
Yeah, so when you spoke to people, let's stick just, I think, it's actually a really interesting discussion to the earlier part of the crisis, 07, the pressure in the funding markets, in particular in the banks, the collapse of the ABCP market, for example, is notable. $400 billion of ABCP goes away over those few months. When you were talking to the banks, were these mostly commercial banks or
yes.
the investment banks as well?
Commercial banks. Banks that are in play in the funds market.
And they were feeling that they had no balance sheet or were having trouble getting balance sheet.
The traders.
Okay.
It's anecdotal. I don't want to, but I found it useful.
No, it's very useful to hear, because part of, to be honest, part of our mission as a commission is to sort of explain the evolution of the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And some of this crisis, as Gary Gordon and some others have pointed out, happened in markets that the American people don't frequently see.
The repo right. market he focuses on.
In particular, the repo market he focuses on later in Bear. But in general, wholesale funding markets are not something that's transparent.
Right.
So we've heard from other people, and it's good to hear you confirm that even with that first spike in LIBOR OIS in 07, you know, the markets were tight. The banks were talking about having trouble.
Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a common view of what was caused by.
You know, so, and all the, you know, the American people first sort of saw this with the write-downs at Citi or the write-downs at HSBC.
It was a year later.
Right. Late in 07, you start seeing the major write-downs at the banks, largely because the off-balance sheet vehicles come back on balance sheet, at least in Citi's story.
That's right. That's right.
Do you have a view about sort of whether the opacity, well, if there was a sort of an opacity as to where the credit risk lay, and whether that was more about the off-balance sheet type accounting, or whether it's more about the complexity of the assets, which I do know you refer to in your book?
I don't have a way to determine which is more significant. Incredible complexity of the assets is and where they were. I think I called it the Queen of Hearts problem, Queen of Spades, excuse me, problem in the book. No, I don't have a way to quantify that. I think it's and to this day, there's still people who are saying that there's still lots of toxic assets, and they're just as complicated on the bank's balance sheets. So I think it's still more work needs to be done. I don't have a way to get the estimates there.
When you, it's interesting. One of the measures you use to disentangle liquidity and counterparty is this: the repo spread versus, I guess, LIBOR or OIS.
Right. Your LIBOR, yeah. So is
right. It's a LIBOR
the idea is secured and unsecured, repo secured, and LIBOR is unsecured. That's the concept. That's what we originally did. We used the CDS rates and things like that, but that was it.
Did it surprise you when you read something like Gordon's work and you see that there actually runs in repo markets and in repo markets with collateral removed from what we consider to be the most toxic, that even a secured funding market in a time of panic? Which you would think to be a secured market that should not have counterparty risk. I'm going to hold the collateral if you default. Still is subject to a run.
Yeah.
How do you react to that?
Well, I think it's a concern. I don't. I think the analogies of bank runs still need to be. Deposits and repos are different items. But remember, my work with John Williams occurred much earlier, so it didn't have that problem at the time. In fact, we haven't really extended our work through the panic period that was done before the, you know, by the way, I define the, I think, and maybe we can come to this later, I think it's useful for analyzing what happened to divvy up the crisis into three periods. The panic, which is roughly late September to early November, and then the pre-panic, which is August 9, 2007 until the panic, and then the post-panic, which is what happened roughly since November of 2008. And things are quite different in those different periods. The responses, I think I would say the Fed's response in the panic period was quite constructive. But we're now, most of my work about the causes of the crisis occurred before the panic period. I've done a lot of work on the responses, but we're not really addressing that in this interview. Okay. I guess
we'll like to. Whatever you'd like to.
Okay. Well, whatever.
We can discuss the panic period. I mean, if you think
whatever you like. Yeah.
Because I think we've covered a lot of the pre-panic sort of what you've written. You haven't changed very much from that, even given some of the new evidence and some of the rebuttal. You seem to
respond. Yeah, I think I would say, for the most part, I'm surprised about how much work is supportive of this original thing done in the summer of 2007. In response to
it was
a request, pressing. Just do analysis of the relationship between monetary policy and housing, but especially the international side. I mean, that OECD, I just was amazed that these guys found that early. That was really early on. It was just, I think, a couple months after I did my piece. And it was maybe not that soon, but certainly within 6 months. And I found out about that piece because I presented some of this work the first time, the big picture work at the Bank of Canada, in November 2008. And so people at the Bank of Canada found out about this OECD, and so they told me about that. And so I was... So I'm trying to say that, from my perspective, I'm really quite struck about how common this view is now, and that there's a lot of support. Now, I know that there's people on the other side. And in some sense, I was thinking about this the other day. In fact, at my paper at Jackson Hole this summer, I was commenting on Charlie Bean. I just reflected on the fact, why is it we're all looking at the same data? We have different priors, that's for sure. But statistics is supposed to be able to bring people together. You know, the posterior distributions are supposed to be closer than the prior distributions. And they don't seem to be budging very much. People are sticking with their priors. And it's an interesting thing. That's why I say, I think from your perspective, you can help, or maybe it's not your job, it's someone else later to go back. But the idea of having all the studies there to, and then sort of make an assessment would be good. But when I say I haven't changed, I know there's now other things that happen. We all do. And for the most part, say for example, counterparty risk versus liquidity, I'm much more convinced that we were right early on. The low interest rates I'm more convinced about. I've learned more about Fannie and Freddie. I've learned more about the panic period, especially, and the role of the Fed in the panic period, which we've all learned more about. So there's more that's happening, which I think is valuable.
So I guess to keep this, let's do the panic period. I guess that's interesting. So what do you think now about, you mentioned the Fed actions being helpful during the panic.
Yeah,
you do an original event study and try to argue whether it was really Lehman or whether things after Lehman.
Well, that part is, I think I still feel pretty confident in that part, that the way I put it there, I think pretty closely, is that the problem here was this kind of ad hoc, frantic sometimes, series of responses of bailing out some and not others. And that, I think, is what eventually spooked the markets. And so that's a long series of things that happens, not just Lehman, but Lehman's part of it. Bear Stearns is the intervention to bail out those creditors through the Fed. Fed uses balance sheet. And in any of these cases, I'm not in the room, so I don't know. I do know what it's like to do things when it's a panic situation from my work at Treasury, but I was not in the room for these cases. And I think that what I'd like to say is, let's give the people in charge the benefit of the doubt about Bear Stearns. But then it seems to me that was an opportunity to clarify as best as possible what the strategy would be going forward. And I didn't see any. If anything, if you read what the officials say, is we'll do this for anybody. And people thinking about Lehman at the time. The examiner's report for Lehman goes back and quotes top officials saying Lehman's right there, you know, at the time. And so every expectation was that Lehman would get the same treatment. And then you had in the summer, you had Fannie and Freddie and the Fed willing to do bridge loans, which is sort of similar to the bailout approach. And then you have Lehman, and that weekend, I assume you're getting all the information about Lehman weekend you can. My favorite reading on that is not Sorkin, although he's fun to read, but the examiner has a great little 20 pages on Lehman weekend. Anyway, so it seemed to me that was not one was saying we're going to, you know, prove a lesson about moral hazard. That was an attempt to bail out through the private sector, and it failed, and they weren't ready for anything, any plan B. And so that was a huge surprise. And then the next day they go back and the balance sheet's open again for AIG's creditors, and then it pulls back again. We go for the TARP, and then huge confusion about the TARP. And that lasted for 3 weeks, and I think that's really the heart of the panic, is really from the announcement of TARP and the chaotic rollout of that and the confusion about what it was. Remember, there was this three-week period where it was going to buy toxic assets. And you look at LIBOR OAS just zooming up through that whole period, and then something happened on October 13th or the weekend before, that Monday. And what I think it was the clarification when they brought Paulson brought the bankers in, that this is going to be used for equity. And then you see those spreads come plummeting down. Other things happen too, but that seems to me, that's what I thought was the reason. With respect to the positive things, because that I think is all unfortunately negative. I think that was harmful. Again, you have to, we're looking at this after the fact, but actually to some extent for me it wasn't after the fact, because I was kind of involved in doing studies. And in fact, in the summer of 2008, we had a little conference at Stanford where one of the purposes of it was to argue that there should be a clearer policy with respect to the bailouts. I gave a little talk about that. We had some officials from the Fed there. So it's not completely Monday morning quarterbacking, but I'm not in the room, so I just have to give people the benefit of the doubt. But I think that was quite harmful, and it shows to me the real dangers of discretion, the fact that the bailouts situation, which I think we still are subject to, is extraordinarily dangerous. And it's just too hard to deal with this in such a discretionary fashion. So we need a better approach. Anyway, in the panic, the Fed did swap lines. Central bankers came together. They showed a great deal of cooperation and coordination. I think that built confidence. Now you talk to foreign central bankers, they have no criticism whatsoever of the Fed in this period. There was definitely a huge amount of coming together. This is a period of great concern. And then the actions to support the money market mutual funds and the commercial paper market, which there has been some, I haven't done that research myself, but there's some good, I think some good research at the Fed about that. So then, if I just maybe quickly mention, I think post-panic, here, I'll just make just a couple sentences and you can ask me. I think post-panic, the operations, long-term asset purchases, I don't think they have been effective, and they've now blown up the Fed's balance sheet in a way which is of a concern.
There is great uncertainty, and the TARP did change its, at least from its announced purpose. Would we have you thought about whether we've been better off, we, you know, collectively, either buying toxic assets, or, I mean, the flip side, I guess, would have been announcing a program for capital injections, which I imagine would have been potentially a political Remember, TARP did take two votes to get through Congress.
Careful of the politics, because the politics were terrible. The way they the initial reaction to the toxic asset purchase proposal was extraordinarily negative.
Right.
You know, the testimony of the chairman and the secretary, just the senators just couldn't believe what they were hearing. And the questions about how are you going to ask, buy these, what's the market, just they were not answered, I don't think, in a very effective way. So I think that was really quite severe. And I don't know all the reasons. I think there were differences of opinion within the administration, with the Fed and the Treasury about how to do it. I've heard lots of people talk about that. I don't know for sure. But in a way, I don't think that's an excuse. That's part of the problem, that the Fed and the Treasury should be able to work together. The Fed shouldn't be doing things at the behest of the Treasury all the time. But I think that that period was particularly uncertain and very damaging. So could it have been done in a different way, or was it politically possible? That was such a political disaster. You also had the election. You had the first vote failed. You had the campaign. McCain's campaign was put on hold. Huge amount of extra uncertainty caused about that period. So I think that it would have been, to say what the alternative would have been, so people frequently ask me, what would you have done differently? Well, it depends on when. You know, I go back to 2002, 2003, 2004, I think would have done differently there. And you go up to the period when after August 9th, 2007, well, then you'd see some problems in the banks, you got to deal with those. So, and then Bear Stearns, make an announcement to Bear Stearns. Now, finally, you get to this period where the world's falling apart. What do you do differently? I think just be clear what you got to do and get it settled in the administration. If the Treasury and the Fed have disagreements, you just got to get it settled and come out with a coherent plan. It's not, that's what I think the thing
is. So as best you can, please give us $700 billion. This is what we're going to do with it. We have a plan. We have a plan on how to buy these assets. We're going to use this auction mechanism.
I think that's right. I think that's what you got to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it would have worked better. You don't know.
So both solutions, though, I'm trying to think how to recapitalizing the banks, which is effectively what was done with the TARP money versus purchasing tax assets, they're both going after the credit quality of the assets on the balance sheet.
Yes,
they're
eventually,
they're eventually resorting to that as opposed to the liquidity facilities that
yes.
been put in place before.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, way back early on, if you think the counterparty risk was the problem, then more equity early on would have been. A lot of confusion here about equity. I think that there were lots of statements from public officials saying that the banks should get more equity. Well, that makes you worry if you're an equity holder in the first place when you're hearing these things.
And some banks did. All through 2007 and 2008, we were able to go out and raise equity. Fannie did as well.
That's right. Well, the whole question about the takeover of Fannie and Freddie, I think, needs to be understood better, why it occurred at that point and what was the full rationale. But that's one of many issues. The way that the decision was made or conveyed to the banks about the equity injections raises a lot of questions in my mind about public policy. You are basically telling some banks who didn't want the money to take it or else see your regulators. There's a lot of questions there, again, done in the emergency and the panic, which I think need to be examined for the future.
In what sense?
The idea that a public official will use its power unrelated to this issue, regulatory power, you'll see your regulators, to get banks that don't need the money to take the money. It seems to me that's not good public policy. And then, of course, afterwards, there's all sorts of things that occurred once they had the money in terms of salaries and all the other connections. So the whole idea of the bailouts raises many questions about public policy I don't think it's part of the job of this commission, but it could concern me.
Yeah, no, totally. You're exactly right. The commission has a very backward-looking focus to find the causes of the crisis, and that includes, I think, to some extent, the uncertainty about Lehman weekend. Some people prefer to call it the Lehman Merrill AIG weekend, since all of those were on the table as those 48 or 72 hours. But to the extent that uncertainty through this period, maybe right up to that particular meeting, exacerbated the crisis, I think, or within, that's within our purview if you have opinions on that or views on that.
I think it did. I think the chaotic, whatever the adjective you want, ad hoc, frantic, non-strategic, unpredictable policy made things worse. And then in particular places, you can see that, like Lehman, like the TARP rollout. The Lehman weekend, the way I think about it, again, it wasn't like the government drew a line in the sand, no money. In fact, according to the Examiner, Fed was talking about putting money in. And you probably have looked a lot more than I have. I'm sure, I hope you have. But evidently, they were prepared to, but they didn't want to tell the bankers. So they said no money because they wanted the bankers to put up more, but it was more like a bargaining position. This is what I get from the Examiner's report. So there was the full intention of bailing out Lehman creditors, but they wanted to be more of an LTCM type of thing. And once you get in that mode, you know, your fallback position has to be more than just let the whole thing fall apart. And that's what happened. Evidently, you talk to the people at Lehman Brothers at the time, they didn't seem to know that there was going to be a bankruptcy announced. The first time they hear is on Sunday. So that's... But anyway, those are issues which I wish I knew more about. I wish that the Fed would provide us more information publicly about that period.
I'm not sure we settled it. The commission held a hearing, I don't know if you saw it, early in September on Too Big to Fail, where the general counsel, Baxter from the New York Fed, as well as Dick Fuld, were both...
I didn't see
we're
Baxter's
both there. Baxter, so you can watch that video on the web and see if it clarifies a little more. I think to some people it was illuminating and interesting, and to some people they left...
I'll definitely have to take a look.
With more questions.
Yeah, take a look at that.
It still becomes a very, very interesting question.
I have talked to Russo about it, so... I have some views, but I would like to see that period, the tape.
So to the extent you have mentioned that, you know, if you're willing to give them the benefit of the doubt on Bear Stearns, and then at least Lehman seems inconsistent with that, unless you're part of the camp that believes the story that the Fed wanted to do something but was not able, there were actually legally binding constraints. But in general, this idea of too big to fail, there's a time inconsistency problem here. This is similar to the rules versus discretion that we discussed earlier, monetary policy. You want to promise never to bail anybody out. You want to tie your hands as best as possible. But in the end, if a firm is in fact systemically important, potentially interconnected at the center of a major market, you know, how public authorities are now in a very different situation, ex ante versus ex post. And it sounds like at least your view is, you alluded to, that Dodd-Frank is not getting out of us the way they've currently structured it.
No, I don't think so. Actually, I was a big fan for trying to remove the power of the government to intervene, reduce it. I think they had plenty of power. We saw what they did. I mean, and I think in the case of Lehman, I don't see that they didn't have the power, quite frankly. But they had, there was not a question of insufficient power. For at this point, what we've done is given more power. So I would say, to me, the best way to have handled this, and maybe we still will go in this direction, is to use the bankruptcy code. Lehman did go into bankruptcy, but in a quite chaotic way. The actual process isn't so bad, but the shock was bad. But we did another book in the series. It's called Ending Government Bailouts as We Know Them, and have a proposal in there. It's Chapter 11F for financial institutions, and it's still been expanded. We were hoping that it would be considered in Dodd-Frank, and it was pushed by some, but didn't make it. But actually, Dodd-Frank has a request for a study of it. So anyway, it's not called Chapter 14 because there's actually a open chapter in the Bankruptcy Code, Chapter 414. So Chapter 14 is for financial institutions, and it has particular ways to deal with them, in the large systemic ones, in a way which is, I think, more predictable, less discretionary, doesn't rely on the decisions of the willy-nilly decisions of officials, but it's more rules-based, more rule of law. And I think that's what I would like to do. Then you can be credibly say, if a large firm gets into trouble, we're going to have there's going to be a bankruptcy. It's not going to be chaotic, not going to be damaging, but we're not going to arbitrarily help these guys and not those guys. It's going to be, as best we can, a bankruptcy proceeding. So I think that's the best way to handle it. Then the idea there is you can then say, if you get into trouble, we're not bailing you out. If you lend to this firm, it's risky, you're going to pay the price. And say it in a credible way. And right now we can't do that because if that happens, everybody knows that there's going to be the bailout again. So I think that's the way to do it. I have an analogy of this based on emerging markets. Can I talk about it?
Sure. Yeah.
In the 90s, we had a bailout problem with IMF. IMF bailed out countries, but it got quite chaotic. So there was, of course, you have Mexico and the U.S. And the IMF were involved. Then you had the Asian crisis, and we helped some, didn't help others. Then you had Russia in 1998, and for a long time we were providing support for Russia and the IMF, and then we suddenly stopped, and it was like a huge surprise. So if it sounds familiar, I think it is. The idea is we had a policy of rescuing not so much the countries, but the creditors of the countries when there were problems of sovereign, in this case, sovereign debt problems of expectations of a default. And so in order to prevent the default, which people would view as chaotic and damaging to the system, systemic, the IMF and sometimes the participation of countries bilaterally, including the U.S., they would provide loans to the country to get them over this period. Okay? But again, it was not well defined about when we would do, when you wouldn't. And therefore, it was very hard to say no. Moreover, it was, you had the same time inconsistency question you asked about a few minutes ago. But you then have a situation where it could become somewhat chaotic. And I think the case of Russia, people thought Russia was too big to fail, too nuclear to fail is the way it was described at that point. And then suddenly someone got the idea, well, they're not. And look what happened. Are you, in terms of this, of investors just thinking about which country is going to be bailed out, they're going to look at foreign policy issues. Turkey, geez, we can't. I mean, we have to worry about Turkey. It's right there in the Middle East, an important ally. And so foreign policy would come in. It would confuse. It wouldn't be just an economic issue. So this had to be fixed, I thought, and other people thought. And it was fixed to some extent. And in 2003, I think, the IMF laid out what they called the Exceptional Access Framework, which described the circumstances under which they would provide extraordinarily loans, exceptionally large loans to countries in a capital crisis. And the way that they were able to make that credible, because it did mean they're going to say no, they said they would say no in certain circumstances, the way that was made credible is to have an alternative to the default for a country that was in trouble but it wasn't going to get the money from the IMF, an alternative to default, because default was viewed as destructive and potentially contagious. So what happened was there was an alternative to bailouts created, and that was to include in the sovereign debt of the countries some special clauses. They were called collective action clauses, where if a country did begin to have problems with its meeting its payments on its debt or rolling over its debt, so that's really analogous to these financial institutions, they would be able to ask for a rescheduling of their creditors. And even though there may be thousands of creditors, they'd be able to say, okay, we need a reschedule. Or the creditors could do this. You know, we need an adjustment here. We think you're not going to pay us at all. And the collective action clause was that you needed really 75% of the creditors to agree to this. You didn't need to have all of them, so you didn't have this holdout problem. So 75% was usually what was done. So those were put in the bond, started with Mexico and Brazil, followed up in many other countries. And so once those were in place, then the IMF was able to do this exceptional access framework and to some extent be credible, because at least you could say, well, there's this alternative there. You don't have to default. You don't have to get the IMF money. You can do this workout. And that's kind of the thing that I think should be done in financial institutions. You don't have to get bailed out. In fact, we can say no in certain circumstances, as clear as we can. You don't have to cause this, you know, systemic mess because of a sudden bankruptcy. You have this alternative, which is this Chapter 14. So that's what I think is quite feasible, and I wish we'd go in that direction.
So if we look back at this crisis, again, taking this sort of episodically, you know, leading before 2007, coming up to bear, the situation in the United States is post-fiducia. We have we have a prompt corrective action. Banks at least can be seized. It does leave an issue to the, came the shadow banking system, particularly the broker-dealers. So you have the 13.3 threshold of, you need extraordinary and exigent circumstances for the Fed to actually lend to any of these people. So you have at least that commitment not to do anything, not to bail anybody out. You may not have sort of the equivalent that you've just described the IMF for a clean resolution authority. You have, however messy we think bankruptcy may or may not have been. So I guess I have two questions. One, do you think that was, ex ante, do you think that was sufficient, or were there weaknesses in that system?
Before Dodd-Frank, you mean?
Before Dodd-Frank, leading up to, let's say, in 07, do you think that the world, were we in a too-big-to-fail world where everyone knew a large bank would be bailed out even with prompt corrective action and even with 13.3, and therefore either institutions took too much risk, market discipline was weak?
Yeah.
In that first part of the crisis, I mean, did Citi, or I don't want to pick on a particular bank, did the commercial banks, for example, engage in activities that they wouldn't have, or that the market did not discipline because there was a too-big-to-fail problem in the U.S.? Or is that not as much of a problem as
it was there? One thing, it's very hard to measure or prove moral hazard quantitatively, but I think it must be the case that the answer to that is yes. I don't have proof. I actually feel, because it's so hard to get numbers or proof of moral hazard effects, which is what you're asking about,
yes,
that it's best to focus on this fact that it's not predictable. You're going to cause problems by the policy is not predictable. They're both, to me, the problems, but in some sense the problem of unpredictability and no one knows what's going to happen is almost more of a problem than moral hazard.
But do you think it was unpredictable even in the early period, let's say before we get to Bear Weekend, where clearly there's a difference?
Right.
The first use of 13.3, for example, is the term structure lending facility in late 07 or very early 08. And then the PDCF is the second, and the Bayer facility itself. So, but before that, you think there was also a degree of uncertainty about?
But it's also the moral hazard conjecture that you have. I think I think they basically, I didn't think people thought so much about 13.3. A little obscure. But,
it is a little obscure. Forgive me for using
but
the
vernacular.
But
they do remember LTCM. That was kind of orchestrated, coordinated by the Fed. So I think that was on people's minds. There's definitely been, over the years, a move more towards the willingness to bail out. I'm not quite sure all the reasons for that. But I think it's still a problem right now. I think it could be the larger institutions, more people more worried. Again, there's an interesting Alan Meltzer's Volume 2, which covers 51 to 86 of the Fed, has discussion of the Penn Central and how Arthur Burns wanted to bail out. George Shultz, who was OMB, did not. the chairman of the CEA, I forget, must have been maybe, I forget who it was, did not. Evidently the way it was settled is that, I guess Nixon was president, that the Nixon's law firm was involved, and therefore he had to recuse himself, and so they weren't going to do anything. So they didn't bail him out. But if something worked okay, the Fed did it what it should do in terms of preventing the ripple effects, and it worked just fine. So, and there were periods in the past, I think, where people, there's the Drexel case, which people look at. Everything's different, but I do think there's a tendency over the years to move in the direction of more bailouts, and we're still there. I think
we thought we fixed it in 91 with Hedicha at least. And the commercial banking system, because it did have those two elements you expect.
Yeah, I mean, it's been
there's prompt credit. There's both the very high threshold for public authorities to act, or presumably high threshold at the time, and then there's the equivalent of resolution authority under prompt corrective action. But of course, that wasn't available outside of the commercial banking system. And I think that framework is very useful, and as you've laid it out, because at Bayer you don't have you. All of a sudden, with the public authority stepping in, there's at least some people have argued some uncertainty about what that threshold is and how systemic needs to be. Plus, there is no resolution authority or orderly wind down.
Yeah. Well, some people argue, and I probably basically agree with this, but I just don't want to be second guessing so much. Some people say that if we are not handled Bayer the way we did, things would have been a lot different. People would not have, Lehman would have got its act together sooner, wouldn't have continued down this road. Maybe right. My gut is that's true. But again, this came suddenly to these people and they made their decisions. So I feel, in terms of my overall consideration of alternatives or counterfactuals, I like to say give them the benefit of the doubt on that. But I just wish that they could have avoided that somehow. And maybe if there had been more attention to the counterparty risk earlier, they may have. I don't know. But I think it is plausible that if they somehow were able to get over Bear Stearns without using Section 13.3, that things would have been better later.
Do you have any other questions on these sort of timing, consistency, moral hazard kind of issues during the crisis? Because I think there's only one more area I'd like to cover.
No, I think I'm all right.
Do you have any others that you'd like to raise with us or think the Commission needs to think about in this sort of, it's called the panic, and we'll do the post-panic in just a minute.
No, I don't think so. I think just try to get as much of all the sides in to your head or into the analysis or into the book that you can.
We are trying.
Yeah,
we can assure you of that.
There's a tendency. I remember reading the legislation for this commission. You have the A through V or something.
We have 22 causes of the crisis to examine.
22. So I think monetary policy is there at number 3 or 4 or 5 or something. But I always feel there's a tendency for people. It's called like the perfect storm view. I think it's not a good way to think about that. I don't know where you're going, but the fact that a whole lot of things happen together, it seems to me that's maybe because I think there's a particular thing here that's the leading, that comes to the top of the list. But I think the perfect storm things, Nick Brady said recently, or we had a conference, he came out, said that in some sense the perfect storm view is another way of saying it's someone else's fault. And I think there's a tendency to do that. And I think to the extent that you can be, rank or to say which is the more important, I think that's helpful. I think you can do it. It's not easy, but to the extent you can do that rather than say, a whole lot of different things happened, and that's the problem. I think it's not going to be helpful because you want, even though you're not going to make recommendations with this, you want people to learn from it, right? You want to learn from this, and in the perfect storm view, everything just suddenly happened wrong, it's just unfortunate, is not going to help very much. So that's my 2 cents. Plus, trying to bring as much as possible into the analysis, making it clear, which I know you're doing, which is terrific.
Okay. We're going to try. I mean, I think, as you've pointed out, though, it's interesting in issues, for example, of moral hazard, right? It is this two-prong approach. You need, part of having a credible commitment that I won't act is a, you know, resolution authority a la the IMF's proposal behind you that makes the first one credible, right?
So, yeah.
So both of them are necessary, neither sufficient.
And of course, you need both.
You need both. And to argue,
use a framework plus the what makes it credible, the plan B or something.
Yeah. And I think that's similar among the causes of the crisis. There's some that are necessary. There's some sufficient. And laying whether you call those causes or contributing factors, a clear exposition, I think, is something we are after. Discussions like the one we're having are very helpful in that regard. As you mentioned in the statute, one thing we're also supposed to look at are the causes of the economic crisis, not just the financial crisis. So following 2008 and into 2009, GDP constricts at a tremendous rate. Unemployment does shoot up to 10%, and some, like recently Blinder and Zandi, have argued without a lot of the interventions that we've seen, even given their problems, it could have been worse. So what I'm interested in is your view of, you know, how bad was it? What kind of path were we on at that point? And then I also have some other questions about sort of causes of that economic crisis, of the drop in real economic activity.
Blinder, Zandi, and I testified yesterday at the Senate Budget Committee.
So forgive me for not having seen that.
That's okay. That's okay. I'm not sure it would help too much at this point. Ken Conrad called the hearing, so Zandi and Blinder are invited. And then I was the minority witness, in a sense, called by the ranking member staff. And so so I've done, you know, I actually thought, I think that it's a constructive hearing in the sense, Blinder in particular said it's important to get the facts out here, and why we did this study, because he thought there wasn't enough of the facts. So I have lots of disagreements with their study, which is based on my own work, which is obviously, I think, has to do with facts as well. So first of all, I say I don't think we have a credible story that we would have had Great Depression 2.0 with this, without the interventions. I just don't see that at all. I know it's said a lot, but let's just face it, we do not have evidence that that was going to happen. One of the things, by the way, just going back a little bit of panic or pre-panic, one of the things that I found most of concern in terms of public policy is the kind of, say this even if it's taped, the kind of behind closed doors discussion about Great Depression 2.0. That, you know, going up to the hill saying, you don't do this, it's going to be Armageddon. And have riots in the streets, or whatever was said. I think without the people knowing about it. I remember at that time various politicians, senators asking me, "What do you think about this claim that it's Armageddon?" I don't know. No one said that to me. Where are you getting that from? And it really was just not out there at the time. So I think that it's another thing in terms of, I think what would have been better is to try to make these cases, going back to your question before about political possible, make this case more transparent, and we could have had a little debate about it, but we didn't, and I think that was unfortunate. But even now, so Blinder and Zandi come back and they say that things would have been so much worse, we would have had a Great Depression. I just don't see any evidence for that, really. What is it that makes them think that? How would they test that? They don't have a model that really explains that. They have a econometric study which, first of all, uses Zandi's model for the effect of the stimuluses, both the Bush stimulus and the Obama stimulus. But then the impact of these interventions is really not modeled. They sort of have some equations which they say how much TARP reduced risk and things like that. So I don't think it really does, that model provides evidence for this at all. What else can I say? Let's take the impact of the ARRA. You know, did that have an effect? So that there says, gee, we would have had unemployment 15% if it weren't for ARRA. But I look at ARRA in a lot of detail, and I can't find anything like that. Here's an amazing statistic. the federal infrastructure spending out of ARRA is $2.4 billion so far, six quarters. That's from BEA. 2.4 out of $865 billion. It's just nothing there. And you look, state and local maybe more. This is infrastructure spending. State and local maybe more because the federal government sent grants to the state and local governments, but you can't trace those grants very well. We have a little separate research project on the impact of the grants on state and local capital spending, and it's just hard to trace it. We're going to do more work on that. There's got to be some connection. So I find that, and then if you look at very little effect, if you look at the, and this goes to the 2008 period too, because we had a little stimulus, little, now we say little, we had stimulus package, $150 billion, and that was also, had similar characteristics to ARRA, didn't have the spending, but it had the one-time tax rebates, et cetera. And I found early on that didn't have an effect, didn't affect consumption by my calculations, and the same with ARRA. So I don't think it's at all plausible to say that made things better. In fact, now at least by much, obviously it must have done something, but now we also have all the extra uncertainty caused by that, and it's debt is higher as a result. So that's part of the answer to your question, right?
Yeah, exactly. The ARRA, given that we're a bipartisan commission, is one I'm not going to wade into, in all honesty.
Well, yeah, but
the earlier period, I'm curious if you have views about, let's say, Q4 08. All right, so the economy is clearly slowing at a very alarming rate, 6.4% annualized, I think. Your view there, are those, you know, so let me lay out three views that we've heard at the commission, and you can either weight them or tell me what you think of either one, any of the three. The collapse in consumer spending and output is driven by wealth effects, both from the rapid decline of housing and stock wealth, right, which is going to just typical effects that you would expect would cause consumer retrenchment and business retrenchment. A second explanation that's been laid out there is a credit crunch theory, with the collapse of the effect of, you know, great shrinking of the banking system, the decrease in liquidity, the spike in LIBOR, IOS, and interbank lending is going away, and that's causing this constriction. Or the other one's a more psychological effect. It's just literally a panic, shift in preferences both among businesses and consumers, that even if they're not poorer on their balance sheet, they're not going to spend. They're hunkering down. Something else is happening. Do you have a view on which of those was driving that activity may have led to the 2.0.
I think here you got to evaluate those hypotheses is look a little internationally, because this is a huge impact internationally, almost instantaneous. You had, especially if you look at trade flows, but look at other, you know, just it just translated around the world almost simultaneously. And that leads me to think it wasn't so much the credit. In fact, people have looked at the credit side. And there's a World Bank study, I could try to find it, you probably know it already, it hasn't been able to trace the causality very much. It's difficult to do. It seems to me that the wealth effect is not sufficient based on previous breaks in stock markets. That was really the third, you had roughly 28% on the S&P, I believe. And you've also, you had 25%, 87. So it seems to me the wealth effect is not sufficient unless
there's a housing wealth effect as well.
Housing, yeah, but housing, that started earlier.
Right.
In fact, a couple things before I get to the earlier. I think the panic here, if you want to call it psychological or not, I think definitely I would rate put pretty high here in what happened in the fourth quarter of 2008. Because it bounced back so rapidly. You know, as soon as the panic was over, as you saw orders stabilize, I see stabilization really as early as December 08, January 09, in terms of orders for capital equipment. And it seemed to me that the firms are seeing, this isn't as bad as we thought. And things stabilize, and then you see a huge recovery, especially in internationally. Very little impact, after all, for the emerging market countries when it looked really like it was going to be damaged. So I think of that sort of down and sharp up as panic related, people were really getting scared. And as soon as things were clarified to some extent, that stopped.
And there's a clarification that...
And also, so you got to bounce back, and now we're kind of sort of, you know, unfortunately, a slowdown kind of recovery.
Is the panic you've tied already to the sort of great uncertainty and tremendous turmoil through late September, early October, is the recapitalization, the large cash infusion to the largest banks in the country, the impetus for that stabilization as you see it? What is it that makes people come December and come that Christmas time say, okay, wait, it's the world hasn't ended?
I don't think you can. I'd say one is.
I mean, I understand it's a hard question to get to mass psychology.
But I would go, I guess, to the. You did see this improvement in spreads and in the market on around October 13th. The drop in the S&P 500 really stopped, basically. It went down again in 2009, but in that period, it basically stopped. And so I think. That probably was enough right there to say this is not going to be a free fall in the stock market forever. It's basically stopped. And that was, again, the time that the clarification of the TARP was there. And so there may be something to the idea, the expectation here that this is a plan. At least they got a plan. At least we know what they're going to do. And I think that would be beneficial. I can't pinpoint whether it's the equity itself or the clarification that there's a plan or something else that actually happened, but I think as early as mid-October you saw a different outlook. Now, things got bad again in February, and that was really after, I'd say, the announcement of the stress tests. It caused, whether that or something else, the markets then fell for a long time. And then finally, in early March, they reversed themselves. And the reversal, it could be that, hey, we're not going to nationalize the banks after all. Or it could be that the data were coming in from January, and you got to start to see those, and people could see the orders have stopped moving down. You also, I think, probably began to see bank profits were going to be okay in the first quarter, and so that by March you began to see that.
So you don't see much of a credit crunch story, at least in that first few months of the
problem. Really, no. I think
problem.
It's hard to tell because it's simultaneous with. It's. I think it's more sort of stopping of what you're doing, and of course inventories. Then they accentuate this drop a lot, just-in-time inventories especially. So it just stop orders and. And you just wait. It's a tremendous amount of uncertainty. So I don't think it's the. Obviously, there's some people who could get credit at that point. Trade credit, people say, dried up a lot, but I don't see that as a. I don't have proof that that is really what caused it. I don't think so. I think it's just the. Again, if you look at the equity markets, there's this. Just they move all together around the world in those roughly 3 weeks. Late September, early October. I have some paper. I have a table that shows that really.
You take that. I just want to understand the position that and the position in the trade flows around the world. Fundamentally, as evidence, sort of against the credit story or the mm-hmm. wealth story, is much more towards a
panic.
But panic in the sense of not the financial markets panicking at that point, the you know real economic actors.
Yeah, it's just got to stop here. We're going to stop orders, and then that ripples through very quickly.
That's a classic macro story. If inventories become the driver of the business cycle.
Well, this was a lot of inventories. That's a good. And then the sharp rebound was inventories, not just inventories, but in the international. I think you here the international effects are very. Important to try to understand why things move so quickly internationally.
Yeah, no, it is quite startling. World GDP actually falls for the first time, I think, in some statistics
right.
overall. The contagion is quite the real side contagion at that point.
It was, and then of course the other thing that's non-contagion is you got this much better rebound in emerging markets than in the developed countries. You have, you know, it's like Brazil and India, China, of course, are just going gangbusters as if nothing happened.
Do you have a view why that? I mean, is that because they were less tied to our capital? I mean, so one argument would be they are less tied to our capital markets, that the capital markets did have much more of an effect, and therefore they were immune.
No, I don't think it's that so much, because the stock, at least the equity markets, all moved down. I mean, you look at the Brazilian index. I have all this stuff in my computer.
If there are any particular documents you want to send us, or things you think are, that we should really look at, please send us.
Unfortunately, I got tons of stuff. I want to overwhelm you.
The top five, whatever you think is valuable. Yeah, we've read your book.
In his testimony yesterday, because there was so much emphasis on facts, I listed the papers I've written on this subject since this Jackson Hole, and it's like 30 papers. So I've written 30 papers on this.
Well, if you can, I mean, if you want to send us your copy of your testimony, it would be great.
Summaries and things like that.
Copy of your testimony and maybe the five things you found most influential that other people have done.
Sounds good. Sounds good. I'll definitely.
We don't have a huge staff, but we promise to browse through. You know, to at least.
I'm not going to challenge you to overwhelm me, but
yeah. Scott will read all of it.
Good. Well, I won't be that cruel. I don't have to do that much. That's for sure. There's some repetition.
We'd like to. I mean, I think facts are key. Are there any other issues that you think we really need to address? Any warnings, admonitions, charges you'd like to sort of give us in the last weeks or couple months that we have here? Is there anything we've covered, not covered, that you think are just vital topics we need to look at?
One thing, this is obvious, but it goes to this recent conversation we've had here towards the end. I'd say that you have to be careful using models to assess the impacts of the interventions like the stimulus packages. And by the way, you don't have to be partisan here at all. You're not. You had a stimulus package in 2008, which we have a stimulus package in 2009. So I'm critical of both, and so that's I think of being nonpartisan. So I think it's aside from everything else, I think it's possible to look at these things more objectively. But what I was going to try to say is that the models, using models can be quite misleading if you don't look at a range of models. So, for example, we mentioned Plinder and Zandi. You get similar results. The administration had similar results in a study of Christy Romer and Jared Bernstein. But also the CBO, to some extent, does this too. They take kind of an existing, I call it Keynesian, I don't mean to be pejorative, Keynesian models, and they say, what happens if you have the stimulus? And then they predict there's a big effect. Well, then after the fact, they do the same thing. So before the stimulus, they say it's going to be a big effect because this is what the policy will be. Then afterwards, they say this is what the policy was. It's a big effect. There is no evidence in those calculations. I'd say there is no evidence that things are working when you do that. I don't know if I'm making any sense at all. Here may be another way of thinking. The models that say there would be a smaller effect. So, for example, I did a paper in February of 2008 on the impact of ARRA using a more modern, I call it a more modern model, and got about 1/4 the estimates of the more conventional Zandi type of model. 1/4. Well, if I put those numbers now, after the fact, I get 1/4 the size. It's not. I'm not telling you anything new that you didn't know beforehand. And when Blinder and Zandi did their calculations, or the administration, or any use of a conventional model, that's what they do. They take the same kind of calculation and say you increase G, and Y goes up by 1.5 times that. Now we say, oh, G increased, so Y went up by 1.5 times that, and that's the impact.
As opposed to reestimating the coefficient.
And this is harder, or just look at what happened. Hey, we sent checks to people, and personal income rose, but consumption didn't rise. Let me show you one chart here that I used yesterday. Or you look at how much did government purchases actually rise, and could they possibly have explained this rebound? And so I'd say those are looking at the raw facts. Now, without a model. Now, you can't, as you know very well, get rid of models completely. But you don't want your analysis to be so dependent on models. So there's two ways to do it. One is you use a range of models, And that's what I would say. At least you got to look at other kinds of models, like these more modern models. And there are those around. But to rely like on just the Zandi model, you're just not getting any information. It's just that the model's telling you everything. You're not getting any information. If you use my model, the one I like to use, you're not getting any more information. And there's two different answers there. So I would say, in sort of thinking about what worked and what didn't, you've got to take that into account. Okay, so finally, let me get
When you think about the more modern of these DSGE type structures?
Yeah, it would be more specific. It's models which have forward-looking expectations, but also lots of rigidities and inflexibility, so policies can have an effect. But people, to some extent, worry about taxes might be higher as a result of the stimulus, or they think about future interest rates. And these are, as you know, these are the kind of models that we teach our graduate students. We don't teach them the Zandi type models or those models for right or for wrong. And so I'd say let's not take a position on what's right and what's wrong.
I mentioned their paper not because I'm putting undue weight on their paper, just because it recently came out, and even not their results, but the Blinder and Zandi piece.
Well, it's got huge publicity.
Yeah,
I mean it's really amazing to me. I mean, one paper, it got huge publicity. I think the reason is they said it worked. People thought, how could it? Everybody in America thinks it didn't work. So it's news when somebody finds it works. That's what I think ultimately is what is going on there. Senate Budget Committee.
All right, I'll be right back.
Okay, let me just show you this one plot
sure.
here. Guess we got to stop. This doesn't tell you everything, but this comes from BEA directly. This is can you see this?
Yes.
It's a decomposition of real GDP growth, which is the blue line. So there you see the collapse mm-hmm. you're just talking about, and you see the recovery and then the slowdown again. And this is the amount of that that's explained by investment, including inventory investment. So it's basically looks almost like the whole story. Now that you can do the same thing with consumption and net exports, and it's obviously not as close as this. So that's why I sometimes say this collapse is driven by investment. Early on, it's a little housing. Okay, then.
So it looks like, if I read that, the 07 to 08 could be, since it explains less of it, I would expect that is more going to be housing and consumer retrenchment and the slowing of the economy as a result of those effects.
Yeah, and I think also, remember, the recession is dated December 07.
Right.
So, and I think ultimately, I think people will see that things start to deteriorate before the panic a little more. You know, it's we need more work on that. I've done some work on daily data. This is same real GDP growth. This is contribution from non-defense federal purchases and from state and local government purchases. So these are just raw data. This is table two of the BEA accounts. And it just makes you wonder how could this be explaining the recovery or whatever. And so no model here. So more of this kind of thing. And the other, I guess, the example of just pure data is I have a chart in here. This is before ARRA. I guess it's hard to read upside down. This one.
Oh, feel free to.
This one.
Right, this was the original,
the
2008.
And if you look at the beginning of ARA, it looks the same. It doesn't prove, there's no model here at all. You can estimate a consumption function and support it, but this is just say, let's look at what happened. And is there, you can say, oh, this didn't impact because something else was drawing consumption down. I mean, some people say, well, what would have happened otherwise? Can you find anything? I can't find anything.
No, and the other approach, of course, is then to look. You could look at you need some more micro level data, which is generally my bias, but in particular income deciles or something of the sort, if we could have that, right? So it may be a small effect, or maybe a very targeted effect that's dwarfed in the macro number.
Right.
So I'm trying to, what comes to mind is there's an interesting study, I can't remember. think this was one of the rebate checks under some program or other. They had a source of random variation because some people got this. It might have been this one, right, by Social Security number, right? Some of the, I think the 2008 ones may have gone out by Social Security number, so some people track consumption by week or by month see if at least, let's say, for the poorest people, you do have an effect on consumption.
Yeah, $300 there's means been a whole some lot. Micro-studies, and they've seen, they've shown more than this indicates. The other interesting thing about ARA is, and there's just this recent study out of Michigan, or Matt Shapiro, just a week or so ago. He looks at the marginal to consume from the increased withholding and gets very, very small. So there was in the ARA you had decreased withholding.
Decreased withholding.
Yeah, in ARA you had some one-time checks, and then you had withholding rates down. And they try to estimate using the micro data that, and it's even smaller. It's like 15% or something.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I think the...
Although it's going to give a lot of credence to our behavioral colleagues, because you know check changing just a little bit is different than some check coming in the mail.
Yeah, right? It will. I'm sure it will. So,
well, if you could share, I mean, if you're willing to send us your testimony in those particular charts, I think the investment chart's actually quite a fascinating one. And
I will. Well, if I could just say one thing about the different models. Where can I go to look at this one? I did this to show about the models. So this part of this was in a New York Times article in November of last year. And it purports to show that the stimulus, the ARA in particular in this case, prevented a worse situation. So they have three models. I would say they're classic Keynesian models. Macro Advisors, Moody's, this is Zandi's model, and whatever IHS Global Insight is. And so they say with the stimulus, without the stimulus, so it looks big, you know. So that's what they're putting that through their model. Now, if you use the model, the so-called New Keynesian model from the ECB, and use the same methodology, that's what you get. So the models make a huge difference.
So all of these are presumably estimated. These are coefficients estimated on longer time series relating government expenditure to output with some other set of variables.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And when you mean sort of old style models, these are multi-equation, multi-sectoral kind of macro models with lags.
Mainly they don't have micro foundations. They don't have forward-looking. They don't have people maximizing utility direct. I wouldn't say they're bad.
No, but it's a series. It's a series of, these are going to be a series of macro variables with varying degrees of lags,
right.
And identification is going to come to some set of exclusion restrictions.
Right. Anyway, then just for a joke, I said, "Well, what about Robert Barrow's model?" He says it has no effect. This is what you get from his. So different models tell you different things, and I think we're making a mistake if we just look at one class of models, say, or even worse, one model. I mean, that's really the worst one here is this is the Zandi blunder. So I'd say that's to me. The lesson here is, you know, robustness, or make sure your analysis is not subject to one or even one class of models.
Be interesting to the decomposition of what it is, what factor that's included in the newer model, besides, you know, that drives the coefficients down. Is it the forward-looking expectations?
Yeah.
Which forward-looking expectation? Is it a particular policy response that's not accounted for?
Yeah.
Do that decomposition. What gets me from two graphs that show a widespread to one that shows me none? Because that actually may.
Yeah.
One level deeper, then we can just decide. You know, then it's about.
It would be good to do that. I hope people do. Yeah.
There you go for your. There's your. For if a graduate student shows up, you know, lost
here's
for what their
topic,
second
yeah.
what their second year paper should look like.
Right.
Perhaps building off of that would be great.
Okay.
I would love to thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for your interest. Appreciate it. Yeah.
We're very interested. If there are things that come to mind, like I said, if you could send us anything. That
how
you
should I send? What's the
email to me? I think is probably the best thing to do. To me. I'll give you my email in just a minute.
Okay. Sounds good.
Thank you very, very much.
Okay. Thank you.